Hi, Jazz.
Hi, Lulav. What's something cool or queer or Jewish you've been up to this week?
Oh, heck, I forgot to think of... Oh, actually, you know what? So we had a date and you introduced me to a very interesting mixed drink.
Sure.
What is that called again?
It's called a pickleback, and I wouldn't have described it as a mixed drink.
Okay. So, listener, please look at this photograph while I tell you about the pickleback, which apparently is supposed to be a shot of pickle juice taken after a shot of whiskey. However, I, as somebody who does not regularly drink and also doesn't generally host parties at her apartment and therefore only has a little bit of alcohol, didn't have any whiskey. And so at first I considered using vodka because that was how Jazz introduced it. But then they were like, wait, no, I don't think it's that. And I was like, oh, phew, I can put away this bottle that's been open for 7 years and which I use for little dabs of ethanol to clean my whiteboard off with.
Oh, God.
And instead grab my gin, which has only been open for, when was the last time my mom visited me? Maybe a year.
Okay, great. Sure.
And frankly, the gin was a much better idea. And Jazz didn't mention to me the detail that they were supposed to be in separate glasses.
I did say they were two shots, and normally people don't hear two shots and then mix the two shots together. They just put them in separate shot glasses.
A shot is a measure, okay. Right? A volume?
I mean, it is roughly the measure of how much you put in a shot glass. Also, I expected you would have shot glasses.
I need to find where mine went. I think they are at Tova and Ciel's. But
I really need to clarify that I also really, really don't drink. This was introduced to me by, like, a family friend, and I haven't had a pickleback in well over a year at least. We do have shot glasses in the house because one of my roommates collects shot glasses.
Oh, good. Which one?
Tori.
Okay. So I'm hastily Googling Nickelback songs so I can make a closing pun. Anyway, yeah, instead of pouring out two separate glasses, I just poured the gin and the pickle juice into one glass. Side note, this is the Jewish part. I have pickle juice because after I finished a jar of pickles, I was like, maybe I'll just want to drink this pickle juice someday.
Oh my God.
And listener, that day came. It wasn't far away. Open paren 2005, close paren. And so I had all the right reasons to drink that, namely experimentation and finding uses for the pickle juice in my refrigerator. Yeah, it was just really good. Usually I abhor mixed drinks because they make you taste the alcohol less, which makes you consume more alcohol. And also, there tends to be a lot of sugar, and I cannot handle sugar.
There was definitely not sugar in this one. Also, you definitely did not drink a lot of alcohol.
Yes, I appreciate how you remind me of the fact that I only had about a shot and a quarter. So, yeah, that was my fun, ostensibly Jewish thing.
Oh, that was your Jewish thing? I was waiting to see.
And it was queer because we were on a date.
Okay, great.
What are you waiting for from No Fixed Address in 2014? Thank you for setting me up for that one. What were you going to say?
Oh, I was waiting to see your tie-in of whether this was going to be a queer or Jewish thing and how you were going to make that work.
Okay. Listen, When We Stand Together from the album Here and Now in 2011...
Oh, wow, I hate it. Okay,
sorry.
All right.
Okay, let's just get to your thing so I can close this tab. Jazz, what's something cool and queer or Jewish that's happened in your week?
So it's been a very Jewish week and an extremely busy one.
Mm-hmm.
So one thing that happened is my third grade students were going to have a ceremony to receive their first Siddur.
Aw.
It's very sweet. It's called the Mishkan Tefillah for Youth, and it's like a small version of the regular Mishkan Tefillah. Not physically small. It's actually a very large book. Anyway.
So what is small about it?
I think technically it's like a thinner book than the regular one, but the pages are practically normal printer paper sized, so it doesn't feel like it's small anyway.
Okay.
But also, it's got more accessible versions of all the prayers. I think the print is bigger. There's pictures on the pages and stuff and more explanation instead of just poetry. And the vocabulary is, like, designed for people a little younger.
Pictures in Mishkan Tefillah?
Yeah. It's very cute.
The only art that's supposed to be in Mishkan Tefillah is the Shema.
Okay. There's not, like, art of people, though. Like, they did stay somewhat, I guess, traditional in that sense. Okay. Not to get into a whole thing. I know there's illustrated Haggadot with people in them dating back hundreds of years. Anyway. But they were all supposed to have one. And normally this ceremony is done in person. So they just, like, pick them up when they come for the ceremony. Mm. But this year the ceremony was on Zoom. So they needed to get it a different way. And each kid has a specialized one because their parents write their own inscription to their own child. And I, like, put the inscription in the book. So each kid has their own specialized siddur.
They have a little, like, ex libris in there. Like, those things that are in people's personal libraries that's, like, ex libris whoever.
Oh, it is kind of like that.
Yeah, that's really cool.
It's not as fancy as, like, a book plate. It's just, like, a label, like a sticker. But it's still cute.
That does sound really great.
Yeah, it makes kids feel really special, and I love it. But we had to get it to them. And there's one child who's out of state. So we mailed it to them in advance. But most of them were local, and we'd had a couple in-person events and told people, if you come to the in-person events, you can pick it up in advance. Mm. But not everybody did come to the in-person events.
Baruch Hashem.
Right, which was honestly probably great for safety reasons, but so then they didn't get their siddur. And so then there was, like, a stack of siddurim. And I was like, I don't know what to do about this. So I decided that I would bike to people's houses, because they mostly lived in, like, a fairly close and bikeable radius, and I would drop them off. And I hadn't coordinated this with everybody ahead of time, but I'd coordinated this with, like, 7 or 8 families. And the event was supposed to be on Friday night. But getting everything arranged had taken such a while, and there was so much other stuff going on, that I was delivering things earlier in the day on Friday.
Yeah.
And I was like, this is fine. It'll just take a couple hours. The event isn't till 6 o'clock. I'll leave my house at noon and drop these off for a few hours and then, like, come home and get showered and changed and it'll be great. And I'll have time to hang out at home. I was going to talk to you.
Yeah, we were going to record this particular episode.
We sure were. But I got up kind of late in the day and I ate a late breakfast at, I don't know, maybe like 10 o'clock. But I still left at noon on time.
Okay.
And biked with this very heavy backpack full of books to people's houses to drop them off.
Ugh. I was wondering how you were carrying all of those.
Uh-huh. And it took longer and was slower than I had anticipated to drop them off. And around 2 o'clock, when I'd really only dropped off, I don't know, 5 of them.
Oh, no.
It occurred to me that I also had not had lunch. And hadn't packed lunch, and also had neglected to pack a water bottle.
Babe.
And I was like, this is fine, because there's only, like, a couple more, and then I'll head home. In theory, I was mostly done, and I didn't have that many books left in my backpack. Like, I was actually pretty close. But most of these siddurim I had at my house. Like, I had brought them home on another day. But there was one person who was very sure she hadn't picked up her child's siddur, and I didn't have it, so I figured it must be at the synagogue. So I went to the synagogue, and sure enough, it was there. So were a stack of other siddurim.
No!
So I was like, okay, well, I guess I should bring these with me.
No, you should eat lunch and drink a bunch of water and maybe lie down for like 30 minutes.
So I brought them with me and I had a handful of families emailing me to be like, can you bring them over today? I know we didn't figure this out further in advance. This is not their fault. There was a lot going on. There's been a lot going on. I had written to parents and said, like, if we haven't coordinated, like, contact me ASAP. And I just hadn't realized how many people that would be because I thought I'd coordinated with basically everybody.
That's rough, buddy.
Anyway, the short version of this is I mostly did not drop those off with people, but I did try and bike to some houses that were very far away. And that was not a good idea. And there was a point where I was, like, biking somewhere and I was, like, a little faint and I was carrying, again, an extraordinarily heavy bag of books.
Yeah.
And a dude who I did not know, who was, like, maybe in his 60s, looked at me and I, like, wobbled a little on the bike and remembered that my roommate's bike, which I was borrowing, is a little bit broken. And the dude just said to me, now watch yourself. And I was like, this is maybe a bad idea. I don't know that I can do this. And I walked my bike the rest of the way home and wrote to the other families and were like, I will get these to you another day.
Okay. Yeah, that seems like a reasonable way to take that.
right. And then I went home and collapsed and then took a shower and got hydrated and ate some food and was all prepared for a actually very, very lovely ceremony that night.
Oh, good.
With families who, if they had received their sidur that day, were like very happy. And I think the ones who hadn't, like, were also okay.
Mm-hmm.
But everything turned out well and turned out fine. And also would maybe recommend having a little bit more foresight than I personally did.
Here's the thing. It's not incumbent on you to deliver every single sidur yourself on a bike, but you can't just ignore that work. And I think you struck a nice balance there.
Cute.
Maybe a little too far towards the personally delivering every single book, but good balance in general.
I am going to get those sidur into the rest of the families. Like, by the time this episode goes up, they should all have it.
Yeah, I hope so. Because we're back up to, like, 3.5 weeks of backlog, right?
Like 3 weeks in advance. They should all get it over the next couple weeks.
Good.
But I did share this story with someone who was like, great, so the next time we have something that's going out to all of the families, which is coming up in December, we're going to have a large team of people do it, and we're going to have more than one day to do it.
Yup. That seems like a much more reasonable institutional decision than making it your job.
To be clear, the institution did not tell me to do this. I was just like, this is manageable. And my boss was like, you don't have to. And I was like, this seems manageable. And it was not manageable.
Oh, boy. Anyway, speaking of managing things, do you want to manage our way into this episode?
It was a terrible transition, but yes, I do.
That was the best segue I could come up with.
It was pretty good. Kudos.
Anyway.
1, 2, 3. 4.
Welcome to Kosher Queers, a podcast with at least 2 Jews, and generally more than 3 opinions. Each week, we bring you queer takes on Torah, their jazz,
and she's lulav.
And we're here to joke about Judaism and talk Tanakh together. Today, our chavruta is learning the Haftarah of Toldot, which is from the beginning of Malachi to chapter 2, verse 7.
Yeah, it sure is.
So that's usually pronounced Malachi in English, right?
Is it? I have no idea.
How do you say it?
Malachi.
That's so good. I'm really glad.
I really don't think I've ever heard this word pronounced before. So I was just guessing based on looking at it.
Yeah. It literally means my messenger.
Yeah, which is very confusing for me.
Okay. Say more.
So, okay, this is anonymous, and that's why it translates to my messenger, because we don't know who the prophet is.
Mm-hmm.
But I went to go look it up because I was like, is this prophet's name just Angel? Like, was that just his name? Was that a normal name? Like the love interest in Buffy? And I don't think so. It's just that...
Oh, that really put a sword through the heart of your theory, right, as it got reinsold.
Anyway.
That really moved to Los Angeles. Sorry, I watched all 6 seasons of Angel.
You did? I really only watched a couple seasons of it. I couldn't deal with it because there was a moment where... Anyway, it's fine.
Yeah, it was bad. However, as a lesbian, I was mostly watching it for Amy Acker and Charisma Carpenter, who were, like, the only 2 redeeming things about that entire show.
Charisma Carpenter is really cool. Anyway... Malach is often used to mean angel, but mostly because angels are so often used as messengers, and messenger is like a little bit more of an inside translation of it. And so here it's just being messenger. And I think this is related to the idea that angels have just like one job. Each angel just has one job, and they're just like messengers of God sent to do whatever their particular thing is.
Yeah. And this book executes its one job fairly quickly. There are about 3.5 chapters, and we're reading a little over one.
Yeah, we're reading about half of this quote-unquote book.
No.
Yes!
Oh, dang. It is half. Chapter 3 is really short.
Yeah. Anyway, we're reading about half of it. I said quote-unquote book because I guess there's some debate about it in that there's 12 of these who are, like, the minor prophets who are all bundled together, and sometimes that's considered, like, one book.
Mm. In addition to reading Malachi this week, last year we read Toledot. So, Jazz, how much time do you want to tell us about that particular parsha?
I didn't time it, but I think it's a long one.
Ooh, 75?
Yeah, let's try 75 and see how that goes.
Okay. 3, 2, 1, go.
Yitzchak and Rivka had 20 child for years, but then Yitzchak decided he wanted kids. Rivka had a hard pregnancy and did some magic about it, but her twins, Yaakov and Esau, still fought all the time. Plus, on top of that, suddenly there wasn't any food, so they traveled to another place and Rivka had to pretend to be Yitzchak's sister. But if they'd really wanted to pull that lie off, they probably shouldn't have had sex in a public place nearby the king. Maybe Rivka missed her more wild childless days. Yitzchak made a lot of money there and got in a spat with the neighbors, so the king told him to scram. Yaakov buys Esau's birthright with some red soup, and Rivka doesn't like Esau's wives. Rivka devises a plot to have Yaakov inherit, which involves tricking her practically blind husband, and it works. Esau gets a regular candy bar instead of a golden ticket and a whole chocolate factory, and Rivka sends Yaakov off to her brother's house so Esau won't kill him. Before he leaves, Yitzchak takes Yaakov aside and makes him promise not to marry anybody Rivka wouldn't approve of because everyone knows she really runs things around here, and gives him an additional candy bar, blessing, for good luck.
I'm so glad you had 12 seconds left.
Great!
65 would have done it. That really brought back that whole story. What a good summary.
Thank you! There was a lot going on.
There was.
Also, I gave you a very Rivka-centric version of the story, but I do feel like that was a very accurate summary of what happened.
Right. She's a lot of the driver for family decisions in a way that Yitzhak isn't quite.
Really isn't. And I think normally Yaakov is the center of this story, but he's like a child for the first half of it. So it didn't feel right to center the narrative around him.
So, can you tell us a little bit about how that connects to the Haftarah portion we read today?
Yeah, the Haftarah portion opens with comparing the current state of Am Yisrael to Esau and Yaakov. Good. And in particular, they're fighting with their neighbors, who might or might not be the Edomites also. Certainly they have had Edomite neighbors who they have fought with. Anyway, so God is talking about, you're fighting like children. I still love you. You're still the favorite, even though you're fighting like children.
Mm-hmm.
And there is some emphasis on you are the favorite, even though you're being a real little brat.
Yeah, that seems about right. There are also some interesting family dynamics that we'll talk about when we walk through this Haftarah portion.
Uh-huh.
So a little bit of the background. This is the last book of Nevi'im in the Jewish tradition, but also it's like the last book of the Old Testament in the Christian Bible as well.
Do they tack on more prophets or they just put on the New Testament?
So none of the New Testament is Jewish writings. It's all fan fiction. But the order of Nevi'im and Ketuvim in the Christian Bible tends to be out of order. Like, the writings are mixed in with the prophets, and it's a whole thing.
Oh, that's confusing.
Yeah, I could actually look up a list of the difference between the canonical Hebrew Bible and a variety of Christian... Yeah, here we go. So they divide it into the Pentateuch, histories, poetical / wisdom books, then all of the prophets.
Okay, so where does Kings live? First and Second Kings.
So Kings is our 1, 2, 3, 4, 5th and 6th book of Nevi'im. But in the Catholic Bible, it is Ruth goes right after Judges. And then it has like Samuel, Kings, and Chronicles. We put Chronicles 1 and 2 into Ketuvim.
Yeah.
So yeah, they just kind of disregarded
the order,
whatever was going on.
Sure.
So that was interesting. Haven't looked at that chart in like a couple years.
Uh-huh.
I like my book less than I did when we began this podcast, but...
Oh, the NRSV?
Yeah, it's got some helpful reference stuff in it.
Okay.
Unfortunately, not as helpful as it could be in the Jewish context, because...
It's out of order.
I would actually have to check it. Oh, it is out of order. Never mind. I just like this book more. But yeah, the thing that I do like about my particular copy is that every book begins with like, here are some things about the poetry and a little bit of the historical place of it and like an overview of what goes on.
That's helpful. My very old copy of the JPS does not do that.
Oh.
Again, okay. The one I have is... very old. It's like from 1955.
Yeah. I assume, though, that even in 1955, they could give a little bit of context for what was going on.
I mean, there's a preface to the whole edition. There's just not one to each section.
Okay. Yeah. So one of the things that the NRSV preface to this section says is that the style here is much more question and answer than it is poetic. And that's something that I agree with, having read about half of it now. But I'm not sure that I would have noticed that on my own.
I did notice that it was less poetical.
Okay.
I don't know that I would have phrased it as, like, it's got a question, and then it spends a while answering it. But that does seem fairly normal to me. I mean, I'm maybe just used to lots of, like, really rhetorical questions after reading a bunch of Talmud.
Good.
So, like, I saw that interpretations are, like, there's... four distinct questions and then four answers, and that part didn't stick out to me as much, but I did definitely see that it doesn't look like poetry.
Right? So let's talk a little bit about why it doesn't look like poetry. So the first line sets up what this is, and there are a couple different translations of this line, as there are of many lines, and I would like to go back to our podcast roots of picking one word to look at and being like, oh, here's what it could mean in this context.
Okay.
So the way that the NRSV translates it is an oracle, period. The word of the Lord to Israel by Malachi. And then the, I think, JPS translation, is that what Safaria uses?
Yep. I'm grabbing some more books.
Says, a pronouncement, colon, the word of the Lord to Yisrael through Malachi, or Malachi. And then the way that I personally translated it was, a burdensome name's word to the wrestlers by the hand of my messenger.
Walk me through yours, and I will tell you what my various different books have it as.
So, as far as I can read this, the actual Hebrew is Misa Dvar Hashem al Yisrael biyad Malchi. Is that a fair reading of that? Did I mispronounce anything?
The only place that I would note is that it's El Yisrael, not Al Yisrael. It's like to Israel.
Yeah, that's fair. Wait, what would Al be?
I would associate that with being like Ein Lamed, like on Israel, like it's a different preposition.
Oh, okay, that's interesting. But yeah, definitely El Yisrael. The Nikud is even those three dots,
yeah,
which we love so much. So basically, the first word is what gets translated in the various versions as a standalone clause. In the NRSV, it's an oracle, period. In the JPS, it's a pronouncement, colon. But this is just kind of in the series of words here. So, like, it's the first word, and then the next word is Dvar Hashem, which is more syllables, for sure. So I like to take that as a whole thing, which I don't know if that's a particularly, like, Hebrew grammatical way to read it.
Is what?
Like, do you think it's fair to interpret this as, like, a burdensome or oraculous names word instead of, like, as two separate things, an oracle colon the word of the Lord?
Yeah, and in fact, I have a translation here that does that.
Ooh, what do they say?
It is the oldest translation I have in front of me, so I have three different translations in front of me because I was curious now that you brought it up.
Mm-hmm.
And the newest one that I have and the oldest one both render this as like one sentence, no colon or period or anything. But the newest one is the URJ translation, who does more of an outside translation and renders this whole sentence as the message of the eternal to Israel through Malachi, and then puts the colon there.
Yeah, that's fair. They just kind of skip the first word as a distinct thing.
Yeah, they just kind of fold it into the rest of the sentence and look at both Masa and Dvar and combine them to be like, message. But my oldest translation, which is from the British and Foreign Bible Society, renders this first verse as the burden of the word of the Lord to Israel by Malachi.
Yeah, I love that translation. I was going with a Kenning because we were translating into English, but, like, that actually sounds much better.
Right? And it's kind of cool, I think, because it brings up that thing about prophets. Like, how a prophet isn't, like, an esteemed thing, and this prophet isn't coming to tell you something happy or that you're going to be excited about.
Right.
Like, the word is a burden. And I don't know, I think that's a cool thing.
Yeah, and I think that works with a lot of our conceptions about what oracles are, that the people who are oracles and bring these messages from the cosmos tend to be afflicted. For instance, Cordelia Chase in the show Angel had really debilitating migraines whenever she got visions of what was going to happen in the episode.
Great connection.
Thank you.
I'll also note that it is possible, and I'm not looking at the BDB here, but at the Jastrow, because the Jastrow is on Safaria, and really I should probably be looking at a BDB, but they do note that there is also this meaning in the word Masa that is like lifting or uplifting, that which the soul lifts itself up.
Oh, that's fun.
I want to offer one other thing that's notable about the grammar here, which is almost all of this is in second or third person, which is to say it's talking about this is what God says, or this is what you, the people, or you, the priests should do. And when it's talking in first person, it's talking in first person as God, not as Malachi.
Yeah.
So the one place here where you could get Malachi speaking in a non-God voice would be in this first line, but because of the construction of this first line, starting with that word, this line is also in third person. Which is to say, we don't ever get Malachi speaking in first person, which feels notable to me because it's anonymous and we don't know who it is.
Yeah, like, that's why I don't like a translation that involves the proper noun Malachi. I think that this should be interpreted as lowercase m Malachi, my messenger.
I agree. And I also just want to have a like little sidebar here.
Okay.
That I think that's cool. And the other thing that I was just talking to third graders about is about like the different prayers and the way that Hebrew is gendered.
Mm-hmm.
And Hebrew is gendered whenever you speak in first person, right? Like it gives you some agency because in English, you tell people your pronouns because they can gender you with them. But in Hebrew, you get to gender yourself whenever you speak. Like you don't have to wait for other people to talk about you.
So what would the feminine conjugation of this be?
There isn't one, because this isn't in masculine conjugation currently.
Oh?
I mean, it is, but it doesn't make a difference. Mm-hmm. Malachi is not gendered. Okay. My messenger, the first person possessive there, is a gender neutral term.
Cool. So it's not like if you were talking about a female messenger, you would say Malachi?
That's a good question. And I don't know the answer to it for absolute certainty, but I think it might just be a difference of vowels. Yeah, I'm not sure. My guess, and the reason why I said that, is that I think that it's just a word that happens to be gendered masculine messenger, mm-hmm. in the way that, like, table happens to be gendered feminine, that it just doesn't switch. The word is just gendered. Mm. I could be wrong about that, but that was my working assumption.
Yeah.
Anyway, so the reason I brought this up is because we don't know anything about the gender of the person who is the messenger here. We're not given that information. We're just mm-hmm. given the information that they're a messenger and anonymous. And prophets don't tend to be anonymous. It's unusual for prophets to be anonymous. Most of the prophets are given names. So I think there's a really good case to be made that there's a reason that this one deliberately doesn't give us Malachi speaking in first person.
Yeah, I think the only other prophet where it is maybe just a title is Obadiah, which would mean servant of Hashem. And interestingly, Obadiah is also the shortest book in all of Nevi'im and Ketuvim.
Aw.
So, right, let's actually get into the text.
I just wanted to offer up a translation that yeah. our prophet isn't a man, and let's keep going.
Thank you. So, I have shown you love, said the Lord. But you ask, how have you shown us love? After all, declares the Lord, Esau is Yaakov's brother, yet I have accepted Yaakov and have rejected Esau. So I was just reading that out word by word to show you it very much is a question-answer sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Where there's the declaration, I have shown you love, and the question, how have you shown us love? And the declaration, Yaakov was accepted and his brother Esau, his hills were a desolation and his territory was for the beasts. And if they ever think, though crushed, we can build it again, I'll tear it down. So there's a lot of stuff in here that I theologically hate.
Okay, tell me more.
So this is, and so they shall be known as the region of wickedness, the people damned forever of Hashem. I don't like the idea of eternal damnation for a people. The idea that, like, because of the way ancestors acted, independent of the way that you're acting now, it's just always going to be a nasty place. This is why I very much sympathized with the outcast lions in The Lion King 2, Simba's Pride. It's just like, there's no reason to ascribe iniquity to the people who are also being economically maligned.
Okay.
And I think that theologically what it's saying here is like, they're just going to be like that forever. And implicitly, they will always be wicked.
Yes, that sounds accurate to me.
Yeah, so it's a very like post hoc ergo propter hoc thing. Yeah, I don't like that thing. And then we have in line 6, a son should honor his father and a slave his master. Now, if I am a father, where is the honor due me? And if I am a master, where is the reverence due me? Said the Lord of hosts to you, O priests who scorn my name. So there's this thing where slavery, or even as the NRSV translates it, servanthood, is conceived of as a natural thing,
mm-hmm.
as part of the divine relationship. And I just hate that.
Yeah, also, Lord of Hosts is a euphemistic translation.
Oh, do you say?
Tzevaot is armies, which is the word here. So this is something of a threat. Where is the respect due me, says the God of armies.
Who, not two lines ago, was saying how a people can be torn down because they were cursed once.
Uh-huh.
So this bit is basically saying, like, the people who are celebrating the traditional sacraments of priesthood are offering not the best stuff that they have. The thesis phrase here, I guess, is the table of the Lord can be treated with scorn. So the examples are like, they're presenting blind animals for sacrifice and lame and sick ones. And hey, if you offered this to your territorial governor, would he be okay with that? No. So why are you giving it to me?
Yeah, I have a question for you a little bit about these comparisons to your father and your master.
Okay.
Do you feel like this is a comparison of, if you wouldn't talk that way in front of your mother, why do you ever think it's okay to talk that way? Or is this, you made a really tasteless Holocaust comparison and I wish you wouldn't?
Woof. You mean like scorned your name?
Yeah, like what's the text trying to do here? Because to me, when they throw like a slavery thing in the middle of it, oof, it feels closer to the like you're making a sort of casual comparison to something horrifying.
Mm-hmm. Which they don't realize is horrifying. I don't think it's like, you know, middle schoolers or I guess also there was a Norwegian college kid that one time. Anyway, point is, it's not like telling Holocaust jokes where you know that's f***ed up. It's just talking about slavery as a totally natural thing that should exist and not even blinking at that relationship being compared to your relationship with Hashem.
Mm.
And I think there is also the comparison to a governor, somebody who is taking care of your province on behalf of an empire.
So do you think all of these are supposed to be constructed in the text? Like, that the prophet who spoke them would have been thinking, yes, these are all suitable comparisons because they're all about somebody who is responsible for the well-being of other people.
I do think that is the case. Okay, so I think the one with governor is a little more mocking. It's less like your governor should be treated with respect and more like, well, if this is the level of respect you give to the governor, why do you not give it to me?
Okay.
But I do think that these are all relationships that would really make sense to people.
And the governor is a secular authority. So right, this feels like a little bit more like somebody comes in and is like, you treat your music-based celebrity like this, go and treat your rabbi with more respect.
I love the phrase music-based celebrity. I think the episode title is Respect for Music-Based Celebrities. Yeah, so it's like, hey, do better about this. And then it gives you another question. Implore the favor of God. Will he be gracious to us? And the answer is, dude, you might as well quit trying to have a temple if you're going to give me offerings that are this bad.
So just to be clear,
mm-hmm,
they don't have a temple, right?
I don't think so. I think this is at a point where there is political favor for rebuilding the temple, but it's still a couple centuries before the second temple is constructed.
Is it? I thought this is like post-temple.
Post-first temple. Because the first temple was destroyed by the Babylonians in the 500s BCE. And then the second temple began construction in like 20 BCE. And it was destroyed in 70 CE. So that was only standing for a couple years. But this would have been at least 100 years after the first temple was destroyed.
Okay.
Anyway, point is, yeah, like, y'all might as well just stop this renovation of Levite practice that you have begun if you're just going to offer me nonsense, is the thrust of that bit.
Okay.
And it ends this chapter, which is not actually a Jewishly relevant division, but it ends this little bit with a curse on the cheat who has something good to sacrifice, but instead sacrifices something blemished.
Mm-hmm.
So this is very much like bragging and being like, hey, I deserve the good sacrifices, like I told you to give me.
I maintain that this supports my theory that Malachi is not a man only because it sounds like a mom.
Okay. So the last seven lines begin with, and now, O priests, this charge is for you. You got to do better or I'm going to send some curses.
Okay.
Your seed won't grow. I'll smear your faces with dung from the things that you sacrifice, and you'll be taken out to the trash pile.
All of those things sound like a weird kink thing.
A little, yeah. Okay. And then, like, this charge that I'm making is so that my covenant with the Levites endures.
Mm.
The house of Levi is supposed to be in a point of pride and constant service.
Okay.
And yeah, I guess this bit ends with just like, hey, you are the moral exemplars, so you really have to do this correctly.
Okay. And the thing that they have to do correctly is
offer good sacrifices.
Okay. I actually do have one more thing to say about this last bit, which is if this covenant they have, like you're talking about, well, the covenant needs to endure. What do you think God or the prophet is saying that they need to do to make it endure? And is the prophet offering a reason why they should want to behave differently than they do?
Yeah, I think this reading is a very specific message that the sacrifices being made should be made in full faith. Mm-hmm. Instead of just like, we're doing this because this is what we're supposed to do as a people. It should be like, we're doing this because this is what we're supposed to do as a people. Like, we're supposed to make the best sacrifices and try really hard as a people to live in community.
Aww.
So the whole thing here is very much like, hey, you offered defiled food on my altar that you definitely wouldn't give to the secular authority. And so you're going to do better by offering the good sacrifices.
Aww. Okay, so I was just reading a book called Questions Jews Ask, Reconstructionist Answers by Mordechai Kaplan. I've never read any Kaplan before, but I kept meaning to, and I have this book now. So I figured I would start with this one.
That sounds great.
And I was reading a question that was put to Kaplan, who is the founder of Reconstructionist Judaism. And a lot of his deal has to do with this idea of Judaism as a civilization. So he's sort of upends some ideas of Judaism because he wants it to feel like this is a civilization that we're all constructing together, and it'll look in a lot of different ways, and Jews have to like come together and figure out like what we want it to look like, and we've got all of these different pieces to it already. It's not just a religion, it's not an ethnicity. There's too many pieces for it to be reduced down.
Yeah.
Anyway, so somebody asks him this question that's basically like, your idea that accepting diversity in belief and practice as normal, and that this is a thing that democracy requires, will this inevitably lead to the fragmentation of Jewish life? And Kaplan says, this is not the first line in his response, but it's my favorite line, which is, difficult as it is to get along with people, it is impossible to get along without them.
That's cute.
By the same token, difficult as it may be for some Jews to get along with their fellow Jews, they cannot dispense with them or ignore them, except to their own hurt.
It's like, there has to be diversity in your faith community, because the alternative is you just don't have a faith community.
Yeah.
This will lead to fractures because otherwise it leads to people just not being Jews.
Yeah. Anyway, so I was just thinking about that as you were talking about people coming together with more dedication than they had previously to like build a community, doing what we're supposed to do.
Side note that I probably should have mentioned up front, but works here. I recently watched the Netflix show Grand Army, which takes place in your neighborhood.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the plot lines there is this Jewish girl who's not a practicing Jew, but she likes her friend's rabbi. So she goes to the friend's rabbi for emotional support.
Cute.
And she's like, why are my relationships going bad? And the rabbi's like, well, you could try the Jewish concept of repentance. And genuinely apologizing to people and accepting what comes of that. And of course, just talking to a rabbi once every few weeks doesn't actually mean that you're going to do well with that. And she horridly misuses the concept of teshuvah to not apologize to people.
No.
but yeah, I thought of that because of this idea of like, you can't just do things because you're supposed to do that. It's not like you must do teshuva, therefore you must apologize to people even if you don't actually mean those apologies. It's like, no, offer your best. If you're gonna apologize, genuinely apologize and do it because you want to, supposed to be doing it instead of just like it's your homework.
Yeah. Also, since we don't know who this person is, this prophet, I wonder if there's something of a lashing out you know, of feeling like this isn't working. We're not doing what we're supposed to be doing. I'm writing like an anonymous open letter to tell you all to like pull yourselves together. Things could go really bad if we don't pull ourselves together. Have you seen what happened to the Edomites?
Yeah, I definitely think that's part of it.
And that to me makes the idea of threat also work a little better because then it's a like, that should be a warning sign to us. Like, we got to get it together.
Mm-hmm. Not to bring up an anti-Semite, but I did go to some Lutheran schools. And so I have some very powerful images of Martin Luther just like nailing the theses to a church door. And so I guess the thing I'm thinking of here is some random Jewish dude is just like nailing 95 theses about how we need to be better about sacrifice to the flap of whatever temporary mishkan there is.
Aww.
So yeah, that's the Haftarah.
Sure is. Lulav, are you ready for Rating God's Writing?
You mean the segment where we make up scales and then get those proper rulings out of our mouths?
I sure do.
Cool. Do you have one for me?
Sure. Out of 12 very short books, how many very short books would you give this Haftarah? I recognize not all of the Minor Prophets are this short, but bear with me.
Yeah. So I'm going to go with 9 out of 12 very short books, because now that we've talked it through, I do like that general thrust. Like, I was kind of realizing the thesis of this portion as we were talking about it.
Mm.
And I like that as like a simple, straightforward message. It's missing 3 because there are these assumptions about the way that a society should be set up included in this that I think are counter to the best possible reading of the thesis here.
Mm. Sometimes your radical thinking about what a better future looks like
still involves slavery.
Well, just like carries with it your own assumptions and therefore actually fails to follow through on your own radical ideas.
Yeah. We will not live in Ha'olam Haba.
Yeah.
Jazz, this is a little more open concept.
Oh, no.
Sorry. So you've been sacrificing, like, not the best things up to this point. What sort of sacrifice are you giving the day after you find this short book stapled to the Mishkan? And what are you sacrificing 95 days after you read what was stapled to the Mishkan?
This is a twofer?
Yeah, like, is this convincing? And also, does it stick with you after you've made that initial change? Mm. Or do you just kind of revert? Because it wasn't very convincing.
So here's the thing, right? I think that it is sufficiently convincing that on the first time I get it, I'm like there with a really nice sheep.
Mm-hmm.
But I also think this is a thing that carries with it, like we were saying, like the prejudices of its day and the problems of its day. And also it's still pre-temple and we're not going to have sacrifices for that much longer. And so you have to also figure out how to apply this lesson once we turn to rabbinic Judaism. And so it's not that I don't think there's value in here. It's just that it carries with it so much of like the imagined better future is so deeply rooted in its current present.
Mm-hmm. And the imagined better past too, right?
And an imagined better past. And I do better with imagined better future than with imagined better past. I think imagined better pasts are often just a really dangerous thing.
Really? I haven't run into any recent examples of that.
Uh-huh. And so I think because of that, I would be more inclined to say that it is convincing enough to make me think like, yeah, let's bring some better sheep. But soon enough, I'm over here being like, what if instead of doing that to the sheep, I could use its wool and make something different instead?
Okay. So your rating is a really good sacrifice on the first day and alternative practices to sacrifice on the 95th day.
Yeah.
Cool. I love that. Jazz, can you take us to the close?
I sure can. Thanks for listening to Kosher Queers. If you like what you've heard, you can support us on Patreon at patreon.com/kosherqueers, which will give you bonus content and help us keep making this for you. Also, if you can't commit to ongoing support but would still like to contribute, you can give to our Ko-fi, which is at ko-fi.com/kosherqueers. You can also follow us on Twitter at Kosher Queers or like us on Facebook at Kosher Queers or email us your questions, comments, and concerns at kosherqueers@gmail.com. And please spread the word about our podcast. You can check us out at kosherqueers.gay. Our artwork is by the talented Lior Gross. Our music is courtesy of the fabulous band Brivola, whose work you can find on Bandcamp. Go buy their album. They're great. Our sound production this week is done by our excellent audio editor, Ezra Faust.
Our transcript team of Jazz, Ruben, Dico, and Chesed brings you full transcripts of every episode. You can find a link to those in the episode descriptions on Buzzsprout and kosherqueers.gay.
I'm Jazz Twersky, and you can find me at WordNerdKnitter on Twitter. I recorded this audio on the traditional lands of the Lenape people.
I'm Lila Varno, and you can find me at SpaceTruck6 on Twitter, or yell at me at PalmLiker. I recorded this audio on the traditional lands of the Wapekute and Anishinaabe. Have a lovely queer Jewish day. This week's gender is 2 hours later.
This week's pronouns are V and Vim.